podcast listeners, the polls are in. My guests want me to drink. So let's see over the last three episodes, including today's, if you can hear a difference with the alcohol in my voice. I'm usually content with my cup of tea, but
it's too early to tell.
Yes, this glass is far too full. Welcome to Wherever You Are. I'm Ryan McNeil from Toronto, Canada, and you're listening to the 46th episode of the Matinee Cast. It's the official podcast of thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. By now, the cluster of movie lovers that hang out in Toronto are approaching legendary status, and I think we're this close to eclipsing the Hollywood Foreign Press Association in terms of social status. My guest today was rather instrumental in starting this little broken social scene. The story goes that in the summer months of 2008, Shannon the Moody Moxie and Bob Turnbull from Eternal Sunshine of the Logical Mind and today's guest all got together for a drink, as people of similar tastes often do, and they found that they had so much fun that my guest today suggested casting a wider net at TIFF 2008, and thus the Coffee Klatch was born. On top of being a social butterfly, he is a very well-spoken writer, a man with varied cinematic tastes, and an all-around good guy who shows up at your door with booze. Seriously, dude, you can come by anytime. He is the blogger behind Toronto Screenshot, which can be found at torontoscreenshots.com. Please welcome James McNally to the show. How are you, sir?
I'm very good, thanks.
Thank you. And again, as I said, anytime. You know what? I got to pause this for a second because I almost forgot. You are here, and the bonus of being in studio guest versus being the people who do this by Skype is you get to take advantage of the baked goods.
Oh, yeah.
So we have, I believe these are caramel blondies that Lindsay has made for us, and I imagine they are going to go gangbusters with the beer.
Right on. I should mention the beer because, you know, we might actually get a sponsorship.
Oh, I'd love it.
This is a Quebec brewery called Du Ciel. It's legendary in Quebec and elsewhere.
It's nice stuff, too.
And this is called Pêche Mortelle, which is mortal sin, and, you know, I hope you don't feel too bad.
No, this is great. This is beautiful stuff. In episode 46, we'll be discussing J. Edgar, I'm sorry, checking out some listener feedback about leads, and listing off our top five movie bosses. But first, let's learn more about James. This is Know Your Enemy. So, what was the first film you can remember seeing in a theater?
Probably won't believe this.
Probably not.
But it's Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Wow.
And what? It came out in 1968, which would make me 3 years old. If you do the math, you can figure out how old I am now. But, I mean, my parents must have been thinking, you know, they were going to save money on a babysitter. But who knows? Like, they never knew what they were going to unleash. And I saw that movie recently again, and I don't think I understand it anymore. But it's, I actually do really remember seeing that at 3 years of age, which is really weird to me. But
that had to be intense at three.
It's intense at any age.
Well, but I'm thinking just sound-wise alone.
Yeah, and it's weird to think that it might not have... I can't imagine I was three, but I'm thinking this is when it was in the theaters. It wouldn't have been in the theaters when I was seven or eight. It's still the first movie I recall seeing, and so, I mean, it really must have had a huge...
Now, was that in Toronto?
Yeah.
Okay, because actually that's one thing I was as well about my guests is kind of I get to learn like where they're from. So
I'm not from Toronto, but my parents moved here from Dublin, Ireland, when I was two.
Oh.
But I mean, my first movie, I was here in Toronto.
Wow, it's possible that you might have been a little bit older because back then stuff played the scene.
Yeah, it could have been. I could have been four or I could have been five. But I mean, really, 2001. Come on.
What was the last film you watched?
My wife Brooke and I watched the documentary Waiting for Superman on the weekend.
How is that? I never caught up with that one.
It's good. I mean, we both had previously trained as teachers, so we have strong opinions, I think, about all sorts of things, including child rearing, even though we don't have kids. But it's an interesting movie because it purports to sort of say, here's the problem with the American education system, and it's this easy to fix it. And I'm a bit wary of that kind of simple answer. Mm-hmm. But there's definitely some thought-provoking stuff in there, and there's definitely some really good sort of personal stories of kids who you just feel for because they're in crappy schools and they're trying to get into better schools, and it's a lottery. It's like a toss-up.
I was going to say, now, what is the drill with the lottery? I've only seen the trailer, and is it because so many kids want to go out of district to these higher schools?
Yeah, there are schools called charter schools, and they have limited spots open every year, and there's always more kids than spots. And so the way they do it, to be fair, is just to do a lottery. Like, they don't do a...
And it's not even private. Like, this isn't even contingent on tuition.
No, these are public schools. Well, they're, So, I mean, there's a lot of issues. Definitely, it brings up the problems very well. The solutions, I don't think, are quite as simple, but it's thought-provoking. Mm-hmm. And if you're interested in education at all, I mean, even up here, it's something to...
Yeah. So it's a good doc.
Yes.
And you know of good docs, so I trust your opinion there.
Yeah.
What is the worst film you've ever seen?
This is easy, because I still talk about this. I saw a piece of crap called All the Little Animals, which was at TIFF in 1998. It stars John Hurt. This is a good cast, so I'm shocked. John Hurt, Christian Bale. This movie was so bad that it sort of led to my ongoing hatred of Christian Bale. He plays a sort of mentally handicapped teenager who runs away from home because he has an evil stepfather. He winds up with John Hurt, who's like this recluse who scoops up dead animals from the side of the road, you know, roadkill, and gives them a proper burial. And he sort of teaches this to Christian Bale. It's just terrible. It's an English movie. It's just...
It sounds like it doesn't have a point.
It's just very bad. It's like every cliche of, you know, oh boy, the evil stepfather is just hilarious to watch. Anyway, it's abysmal. It's just one of the worst things. I still shudder to think of that. It's just terrible.
Oh, man. And you know what? You know what's unfortunate is like, I do know that when we talk about going to the film festival and that kind of thing, that we're kind of the envy of a lot of people who are passionate about films, but they don't realize that in seeing some of this stuff blind, you're really in for a bad surprise.
Yes.
So that was one of them. I promise not to give you too much heat, because I always give you grief when this part comes up. But what's a classic or essential film you've never seen?
Well, this is something I've been thinking about a lot. I have so many. And I've actually decided that next year I'm going to do a blind spot blog series where I'm going to try and knock off at least one of these every month.
You've actually inspired me to do that as well.
Oh, good.
I'm going to be doing that as well.
I can name so many, but I'll name one that will probably make you gasp. Raging Bull.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. You're gasping.
No, I'm not. I'm trying real hard not to, actually. just never got around. Like, okay, we've talked about this before. The list is very long.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things, like, it's on it. It's not that you're averse.
I've owned this on DVD for 10 years.
Now you're just breaking my heart, dude.
I could do a whole list of blind spot films that I own. I mean, that I actually own them, and I haven't watched them yet.
I was keeping my, like, yeah. I was biting my tongue. Mm-hmm. I was trying to stay all calm and everything. I can't support that.
You know what makes it worse is, I think, if you're a blogger, it makes it worse. Because my feeling is, I can't just watch this. I have to write about this. So it gives you that extra barrier of, like, you know,
okay,
also it's a film of, you know, it's a classic, it's an essential. You feel like you have to kind of bring something to it. And
right. Now that's where you and I differ, because there's a lot of stuff I watch, whether it's for the first time or since it's just, I'm just watching it, I want to watch it, I want to enjoy it. I've been going through a lot of stuff I haven't seen. And
I'm going that way. I figure I have to do that if I'm ever going to get to these movies.
Enjoy the movies. That's why we're watching them.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny, because I'd send you home with a copy, but you already have it.
I have it.
So... Oh, boy. And last but not least, what's a film you wish you'd made?
This is tough, because I was an English major, so I have a lot of films. The first films that come to mind are films with great scripts. Films that I can remember dialogue from. And those are so... I mean, I've got a handful of those. So, like, Big Lebowski, With Nail and I, some of those films. But if you want to look at a film that I actually wish I had made rather than written, I would say it has to have more than just a good script. So my choice would be Rushmore. By Wes Anderson.
Ah, very nice. Very nice.
It has the script, but it also has amazing art direction. It has a great soundtrack, and all those things kind of contribute without getting in the way of the characters, which I think are really well written. So
it's got enough indie whimsy without seeming too odd for odd's sake. Kind of get into those highbrow films. That's a really, really fine line, and it's an awful lot of times I find that some of these movies just go, just that little bit too far.
And, you know, to be fair, it was the first Wes Anderson film I saw.
Okay.
And it was, what is that, about 12, 13 years ago now? So,
yeah,
I mean,
99,
at that
2000.
Time, there weren't a lot, like, that was pretty fresh at the time. And I think, for me, it's always remained fresh when I see it.
Well, it was a different type of indie cinema, too, right? Like, we were coming off a decade or so of Tarantino, violent, angry, swearing like no tomorrow bullshit.
It was a lot more like a 70s. It was like Hal Ashby. It was like Harold and Maude, that kind of stuff. It was character-driven, but there was good relationship. And one of the things I love about it is the relationships between the characters have nothing to do with their age.
Yeah.
Which I think is very sweet. You got Bill Murray, who's like a middle-aged guy, and Max Fisher, who's a teenager. And they have a relationship like they're both the same age.
Yeah. And then there's the teacher, who's a pretty much equidistant age from both.
Yeah, teacher's probably like 35 or something. So in between both of them. You've got Max's, I guess it's his locker mate or something. The younger kid. And they have a great relationship. And it's the kid's probably 3 years younger than him.
I always think of him as his squire.
Yeah.
You know?
I just sort of love, it's just, they don't, the age doesn't mean anything. They're all the relationships kind of have equal weight, which I think is great.
So. Yeah. Well, there we go. I certainly can't argue with that. Rushmore is an awesome film, and Lord knows I wish I had made it. Well, that's James. We're going to take a second, and then we're going to get to know more about you with your chance to come talk to me. Why are you shaking like a leaf? Come on, come talk to me. Please talk to me. Won't you please talk to me? Didn't get a whole lot of feedback from episode 45, and I'm not sure if that was a combination of my question being too specific or too broad or too boring or whatnot, but I was wanting to know where people get their suggestions for films, where people find out about the smaller films that they inevitably see. Sam Fragoso, who writes Duke in the Movies, said, in the past couple months, films like Harvey, The Maltese Falcon, and Casablanca have become close to me. Perhaps this is because I'm drawn to films that are intense, but contain a sense of humanity throughout. While all three of these endeavors I've mentioned above are exceedingly different in multiple capacities, over time, I've grown accustomed to their atmospheres. Whether it's Bogart conversing tense dialogue or Jimmy Stewart woefully and kindly assisting those around him, these are wonderful pictures and are equivalent of walking into an old hymn. They're comfortable and endearing and will always be. Where do I find out about these films? From my counterparts and those writers who inspire me and broaden my cinematic horizons. I went on with that one for quite some time because we don't have a whole lot of feedback, but I think that's pretty safe to say that a lot of us do find out about films from what each other are blogging about, for sure. My mom left me a comment. She doesn't actually listen, but every once in a while she comments. My mom said that she loves watching Turner Classic Movies on the weekend. So like kind of when she wakes up on Sunday morning, she'll put it on Channel 48 and just let a movie play out. She'll find out about a movie that way. Every once in a while she'll turn it on. She already knows the movie.
Once in a while that happens to me, but you have to turn it on, obviously, before the movie starts, because if you're
Oh, no. She'll drop in right in the middle, and actually I'm thinking about making this a game on my podcast, because she has become a master of dropping into the middle of a movie, watching it to the end, and then coming back to me and asking me what it was she just watched. And I get the vaguest of details. So a few weeks ago she said, okay, there's a guy, he's very sad, and he's in a really nice house. I think somebody's died. I was like, a single man? She goes, yeah, that's it.
Wow. Turner Classic Movies?
No. It was on some other channel that she was watching. But I'm getting, I don't get, you know, she doesn't know Stars.
Yeah.
So I just get the broadest of details. I almost want to make this a trivia game.
That's
What was my mom watching? I should totally do that. Aiden from Cut the Crap Movies, he said Netflix. He said his Netflix queue is never ending. Once you add a movie to your queue, it pulls up about 10 more titles that are similar. And then when you add one of those, you get 10 more similar. It's addicting, but it's phenomenal when you look and you try and broaden your horizons. Do you use Netflix Canada?
I do, but you know, I don't have... Okay, people have told me that there's a queue.
Yeah.
I don't have the queue. Do you have the queue?
I don't use it. That's why I'm asking.
So I don't know where the queue is. I mean, it does... I will say that its recommendations are generally really good.
Okay.
And, but you have to... It helps if you go in and rate a bunch of movies.
Really?
But, I mean, obviously the Canadian site doesn't have the same number of films that...
Yeah, we're a little... what's the word I'm looking for? We don't quite get the good stuff.
Not yet. But I mean, and I'm hoping it's going to get better. I'm a huge supporter of Netflix. I think they're doing their best. And I think, to be honest, there's loads of good stuff if you dig.
Yeah.
And that's, you gotta dig. I'm happy to do that. But the recommendations are generally pretty good.
Well, and then finally, Stevie Taylor from New Zealand. She works at a video store.
So
she's
a woman named Stevie in New
Zealand? She's named after Stevie Nicks.
Oh, that's cool.
She is. She mentioned that on a previous podcast. She works in a video store, so she said the preview drawer at work sometimes has some good little films for her to discover. I'm thinking that's got to be one of the great perks about working in a video store. Where do you find out about new stuff?
Twitter, I guess. People I follow on Twitter sometimes mention stuff. I would say I read IndieWire.com, which is a good source of news, and I read David Hudson on Mubi.com, MUBI.com.
Yeah.
He used to have a column, I think it was, where was it before? Anyway, but he's great. He'll talk about stuff that's playing at festivals and, so, you know, stuff that plays at other European festivals or North American festivals, I sort of keep my eye open.
So you're finding out about them basically like from selected news sites.
Yes.
From news sites that you trust.
Yeah. And okay. Twitter would be sort of a mixture of news sites and personal recommendations. Yeah.
For me, I find that I'm getting a lot of the good suggestions listening to chatter coming out of other film festivals. You get such an advance read on stuff that we'll get later on. So stuff like the Tribe Called Quest documentary, Beats, yeah. Rhymes, and Life, that played at Sundance. So somebody, I heard somebody talking about that on a podcast. Mm-hmm. The Skin I Live In, which I loved, which just opened a few weeks ago, that played at Cannes, mm-hmm. and it did really well. Stuff that comes out of South by Southwest, Attack the Block,
oh, yeah.
did really, really well at South by Southwest. So I find that, you know, when you kind of hear good stuff, like not isolated good stuff, because you can get kind of pretentious festival mindset. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it doesn't really translate over when you watch it outside of a festival atmosphere. Not even all the prestige stuff, but I remember our friend Kurt, he goes to Fantasia every year.
Yeah.
And every year he comes back and tells me about at least two or three stuff that I end up loving. Like, I'm thinking about stuff like Rubber.
Yeah.
Last year and A Lonely Place to Die this year. You know, fun stuff that, yeah. that just... You get some people who you trust their opinion and you let them loose on a free reign of stuff. Good things abound. Well, for the next episode, I'm hoping to get more feedback. I'm really hoping to get more feedback because my question for next episode is I want suggestions for the Matinee Cast. The next episode will mark 2 years of this show, and it's usually around this time that I try to spruce it up and do some different things. If there's things that I'm doing that you think I should stop doing, if there's things I'm not doing that you think I should, longer, shorter, the only thing I will not be doing, and I can promise you this, so if it is your suggestion, shut it up, is I will not be doing this more frequently. As it is, I like the frequency, so that is the only non-factor. But beyond that, I want to know, what would you like out of the Matinee Cast going into 2012? Ryan@thematinee.ca, twitter.com/matinee_ca, the blog, of course, or facebook.com/darkmatinee. Let's go on to the new slang, and the new slang in episode 46 is J. Edgar.
A happy ending will pep up your play. Oedipus won't bomb if he winds up with mom.
Keep it gay.
Keep it gay.
Keep it gay.
Before we go any further, I should mention that it is going to be very difficult to talk about J. Edgar without getting spoilerific. So while we try to keep kind of neutral on that kind of thing for episode 46, consider yourself warned. J. Edgar is directed by Clint Eastwood. It is written by Dustin Lance Black, and it stars Leonardo DiCaprio, Armie Hammer, Naomi Watts, and Judi Dench. It is the life story, sort of J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI for about 40 years through the middle of the 20th century, and gives us a look on his life. I'm almost afraid to ask, but James, what did you think of J. Edgar?
Well, I'm trying to be generous. I would say it's...
No. Go with honesty.
Okay. No, it's a miss. I mean, it's... I'm a little biased against biopics in general.
Really?
Because I think that they try to do too much. I mean, most of these films try to cover someone's entire adult life, which in this case, it does try to cover.
Yep.
Right from the 20s, I think, right up till the 70s, or maybe the 30s to the 70s, which is a lot of history. I mean, especially a guy who was the director of the FBI. So my feeling was that there were... The strengths of the film were his personal life. The, you know, I would say the relationship he had with his... number two, Clyde Tolan was some of those scenes were really good. Overall, all the historical stuff that he was involved with was just like all over the place.
Yeah.
It jumped back and forth a lot as well, which the structure of the film and
yeah, you know, I'm with you. I was really, really, really primed to like this film, and I don't mean this in a dashed expectations kind of way, but between the subject matter and the fact that I really like Clint Eastwood's films, over the last decade or so, I was really looking forward to what he would do with this kind of thing. And let's be honest here. J. Edgar Hoover, you kind of mentioned this. He was such a big influence on American history in the last century. Not even one particular decade, but from the 30s to the 70s through stuff like the Red Scare, through the Age of the Gangster, through civil rights, through, you know, all of it. You read in his story, you know, not in this movie, but if you read his story, there's talk that he was the guy running the country through eight presidents, through two, you know, through a war, through a Great Depression. It wasn't the president that was really running the country. It was Hoover.
There was a lot of stuff, especially during the 60s. So, he obviously, for some reason, had a huge hate for Martin Luther King. There's rumors that he may have been involved with the assassination. There could be rumors that the FBI was involved with Kennedy's assassination, with both Kennedy's assassination. But none of that stuff gets into the movie, really.
No.
It's very much left to your imagination. And I think that disappointed me because you don't actually see him sort of doing very much with that. I don't know. I guess he plants some stories and stuff like that. But, you don't really see any of the real dirty work that you know he was doing. Huge missed opportunity.
Yeah. See, and the funny thing is that if you want to take a historical figure and you want to tell the personal story, you know, you want to say, forget what you think you know. You don't really want to focus on just telling their life story. You want to zero in on something.
Exactly.
So, in this script, what Dustin Lance Black decided to do, and I'll give him points for trying something kind of risky, is that he really seemed to want to zero in on Hoover and his relationship with Tolson. There was a lot of speculation and suggestion that he was gay, that this was his companion. He wasn't really a ladies' man. And if that's what you want to focus in on, swell, awesome. You know, like there's a movie coming out in a few weeks called My Week with Marilyn, which is very much that same sort of way. They're not looking to tell the Marilyn Monroe story. They're looking to tell this Marilyn Monroe story.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Go for it. But J. Edgar still tries to drop in these tropes, these things of how he, you know, what he had to do with Dillinger, what he had to do with Nixon, what he had to do with Kennedy, and it skims every one of them.
Except, and even, well, it skims, but the thing that they decide to spend the most time on is the Lindbergh kidnapping.
Yeah, of all the things
I know, and it's kind of baffling because that's not something that I think everybody would immediately think, oh, that was J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. And in fact, it really wasn't that much. If you read some of the, I mean, I went, of course, afterwards to see if any of this was historically accurate.
You weren't born yet, right?
No, I wasn't.
So, I'm sorry. I had to get it in.
But seriously, Hoover claimed a lot of credit for the investigation and stuff. And in the film, they play a little bit with his, you know, his recollections are obviously not always accurate. But in this case, why spend so much time on it? Obviously, the man was claiming credit for a lot of innovations in criminology and police work, and some of those things were true, but I mean, I would say they gave way more time to the Lindbergh kidnapping than to any of the stuff that would have been more interesting. I mean, obviously the stuff about King was hugely interesting. They didn't talk at all about what he was doing during the McCarthy hearings or anything like that.
No.
So,
nor do they really talk about, you know, the FBI kind of going after the Ku Klux Klan.
No.
They don't talk about they don't talk at all about Dillinger, which I guess Public Enemies already did that. So maybe that was kind of that was their line of thinking, is this was just done 2 years ago.
But they tried to cover everything anyway, and I think it would have been a better film if, say, they were going to do this Lindbergh thing. Well, then just keep it in the Lindbergh period, and just you know, you can get an idea of what he's like, I think, from that period. You don't have to cover his whole life, which brings me to another issue I have with the film when it gets to the later years, which is the prosthetics, the makeup. I mean, what did you think of that?
Strangely enough, I was okay with the Hoover makeup.
Yeah,
it felt like Naomi Watts really didn't have enough. Like, she kind of was getting towards Jennifer Connelly in A Beautiful Mind.
Yeah.
Armie Hammer looked ridiculous.
I that's where I'm with you.
And I could not focus on anything else because it would just looked...
They went
insane. He might as well have been... It looked like he was wearing a mask that he got from, like, a costume
shop. So, I mean, have you seen Drive?
Yeah, I
thought of that scene.
Holy shit, I hadn't even thought of that. That's
I couldn't get that out of my head. The scene where, you know, Ryan Gosling is going into, you know, he's wearing this rubber prosthetic mask, which is so obviously fake. I kept thinking of Armie Hammer as this poor guy trapped inside like a rubber head.
Oh, man, it's insane. And The sad thing is that, and we're going to talk about this a little bit more in a second, the relationship between Hoover and Tolson is actually really interesting.
I agree.
And certainly the way it ages, you know, because yeah. because relationships in general, they change as you evolve. But certainly this one would have changed as they age. But any time they got to them in their older years, I couldn't take it seriously.
And I will say, like, that was the best part of the movie for me, was the relationship between Tolson and Hoover. And I think Armie Hammer is great. I feel sorry for him that they had to probably put him in, you know, looks like pounds and pounds of makeup. Some of the scenes between them are very interesting, very touching. I mean, a lot of it is speculative because I don't think any of that is proven. It was tastefully done. In some ways, I've read that it may have been a little too tasteful. But
really?
Who knows? Yeah. There's one kiss, I think, maybe. It's not exactly a...
There's one kiss, one hand hold, and a fight.
Right. Which ends in a bloody kiss. So, I mean, it's pretty tame. And I've heard people say that Eastwood is very kind of afraid of portraying any kind of sex in his movies.
Yeah, I haven't thought of that.
I'm no expert. I'll give you...
No, a lot of his movies tend not to be... There are a lot of things. They're not what I'd call sexy.
Yeah.
It's funny, because watching these two actors, watching DiCaprio and Armie Hammer play off each other, DiCaprio does not look like himself at all in this film. Mm-hmm. He's got some strange hair going on. He's got contacts and whatnot. He's not playing the magazine cover Leo DiCaprio at all. So watching him and Armie Hammer play off each other, and Armie Hammer is... Man, friggin' tastic.
He's really good.
When he's on it, yeah, when he's not trying to play a 70-year-old dude, watching them, it's really touching, it's really genuine, and I wish that they'd stuck with that.
Yeah.
Almost, you know, than trying to play this other kind of movie. You sort of alluded to this off the top. Are biopics just kind of doomed to fail?
I don't think so. I mean, so the performance I'm comparing this to and that I can't get out of my head is Leo DiCaprio playing Howard Hughes in the
Aviator. Yeah.
And strange how The Aviator seems to cover a lot of ground, but to me it was a much better film. And I can't explain exactly why without sitting down to watch The Aviator again. But maybe that's part of it too, is that I see him as Howard Hughes. I don't quite see him as J. Edgar Hoover. There's been criticism about the casting because, you know, he's much better looking than J. Edgar Hoover ever was and all that stuff. I think maybe when you play one iconic figure, it's kind of hard to do it again. The only other role I see Leo doing in his lifetime is maybe something like Orson Welles.
And
I think I think he could do it. It might be hard for him to do for a little while. He might have to wait.
But I'm just thinking kind of on a broader scale that it seems to be kind of tricky to tell a life story. Whether you're doing J. Edgar Hoover, or you're doing a musician like Johnny Cash, or you're doing, Idi Amin, you're always kind of following the same sort of formula, almost deliberately trying for awards, and the actor who's involved, they've got to tread this line between performance and imitation.
Well, and it's always a movie about the performance. Like, you find these biopics win awards for acting. They never win awards for Best Picture.
No.
Because...
Yeah.
Because they check boxes. They don't actually feel like a real story. They feel like someone is just kind of going through all the checkpoints of somebody's life, which you have to do all the big ones.
Ray Charles, Truman Capote.
What I do think would be better is if a film like this was brave enough to say, we're going to use different actors, you know? I mean, there have been films like that, you know, I think someone mentioned Big Fish as a really good example of a film where someone played someone as a young man, it was a different actor as an old man. Not quite, you know, the actor's showcase, maybe, that J. Edgar or those kind of films are, but probably a better movie.
Iris is another one where you had, Kate Winslet as Iris as a young woman, and Judi Dench, as an old woman.
So here's an example. Who would have played J. Edgar as an older man? I mean, that's just fun to think about. Who would have done a better job?
He's not quite heavy enough, but I think, and he's played a true-to-life person recently, too, but I think David Strathairn could have done it some justice.
I'm thinking, like, Brian Cox or someone
that. He would have done awesome. So it's just one of those things that I got to thinking when this was a biopic that didn't give me what I wanted from this particular biopic was, you know, is there a ceiling on biopics as films? And I'm really, really starting to think there is. We've pretty much gone to town on this movie. I think it's pretty clear that we don't like it. But I do try and kind of end things off on a positive note. If you were going to take one thing away from the film as a souvenir, if there was one thing that you liked, a line, a shot, a performance, something, if you were to keep one thing from J. Edgar, what would be your souvenir?
There's a great scene in the film. I don't think I'll be spoiling anything. When Hoover asks Clyde Tolson to be his number two, he hasn't been with the agency that long. He's really not qualified for the job. He says to him, I want you to be my number two. And Tolson says, under one condition. And he says, what's that? And he says, well, that no matter how bad our day is, whether we've had a good day or a bad day, that we will always have lunch and dinner together. And I thought it was a very sweet line. It was also very forward. At that point in the movie, you don't really know what the terms of the relationship are. But I found it very touching. It was almost like they wanted to be an old married couple.
Yeah. Yeah,
and that's what they ended up.
It's kind of like that old, you know, don't go to bed angry
idea.
Well, that is a good one. I do like that. Mine's kind of similar, although on a different end of things. Mine is towards the beginning of the film where J. Edgar goes out for the first time with Helen Gandy, who's played by Naomi Watts. And I got the impression it was a first date. It might have been a third date tops, but it was a very early date. And his idea of a date is to take this woman to the Library of Congress and show her his idea of a card catalog that he has come up with. You know, right before, like, he says to his mother, Mother, I've met this woman and we're going to go out tonight. I'm going to go take her to the library and show her my card catalog. And her mother says, Romancer. And what is it? Just cut to the next scene and there they are strolling through the card catalog.
It's a perfect nerd date.
Yeah, not sure. We've kind of gone on about this enough, but on a scale of 1 to 4, James, what do you give J. Edgar?
I give it a 2.5.
Really? So you're still saying, like,
you know, I think the form itself is kind of hard to do much with. I think the performances were good. I like the relationship between DiCaprio and Armie Hammer. I'm being a little generous, but 2.5.
I'll counter because I'm actually giving it a 2. I can see how people would like it. I can see what you would like out of it. It's not the kind of film like Moneyball that I'm going to rail about for weeks and weeks. But it was messy, and I thought it's a missed opportunity. I do hope that another director comes down the pipe sometime and tells the J. Edgar Hoover story. It could be a miniseries, really. And actually, I hope it is a miniseries. I hope somebody at like HBO or Showtime or AMC tells this story. It's handsome, and it's got some really good performances. Leo DiCaprio and Armie Hammer, not the least of which. But it's just so friggin' messy, and I've come to expect a lot more from Clint Eastwood. We could both be wrong. It could be absolutely terrible and a waste of time. We could also both be wrong, and it's the best thing you've seen all year. Let me know. Ryan@thematinee.ca, Twitter, or Facebook, of course. And we're going to take a quick break and come right back with the best of you. We apologize in advance if the top five gets a little belligerent. We've moved from beer to whiskey, but we will try our best to stay respectable gentlemen of the podcasting universe. J. Edgar, of course, is the big boss of the FBI, and in honor of that, we decided to do our top five bosses. Now, these are horrible bosses. Sometimes these are good bosses, but they're all very, very memorable. So why don't you get us started? I didn't rank mine. Did you really rank yours?
No.
It's not really a ranking kind of list. What's your first memorable movie boss?
Mine might be ranked in order of least obscure to most obscure, probably, because...
That's fine. I like it.
So the first one I'll name is actually a documentary. This might actually tie in with one of yours.
Yeah.
The September issue is a documentary about Vogue, and the editor of Vogue is a woman called Anna Wintour, or Wintour, I don't know how you pronounce it.
I always say Wintour.
I think she's fantastic. I've always had a little crush on Anna Wintour, and I think the criticisms of her of being this dragon lady, if you see the documentary, you'll see why they might say that, but you also kind of see the reason why she might be like that. And my feeling about her is that she's just a woman who doesn't suffer fools gladly, and in the world of fashion, there's a lot of ass kissing, there's a lot of fake praise, there's a lot of
and publishing. Let's remember here.
Absolutely.
She is right at the intersection of fashion and publishing.
Yeah, and so, I just think she's someone that doesn't take any BS, and I just respect that immensely. I just think she's fantastic.
I do love that doc a lot, and I'm gonna tell the Anna Wintour story really, really quickly. I read in a book one time about a woman whose daughter was at the offices of Vogue for take your kids to work day, which I'm surprised that anybody at Vogue is allowed to participate in take your kids to work day.
I'm surprised they're allowed to have kids.
And yeah, there's that too. And as she was going down like the main hallway at Vogue where people go left, right, and center, as her 13-year-old daughter was going one way down the hallway, and Anna Wintour was coming back the other way. And just as they were about to cross, Anna's heel broke and she just fell flat on her face. The girl, not knowing what to do, just panicked and kept on going. And basically when she got out of sight, she just hightailed it back to her mom's office and said, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I don't know what's like, she just fell. I didn't say anything. I don't know what I just did. You know, I didn't offer to help her." And her mother actually told her, "Good for you." And when her daughter looked at her back confused and said, "What?" She goes, "A woman like that, you didn't see her fall. You did not offer to help her up. You did not, you know, wipe her down. That just did not happen. You pretending as though you didn't see anything was the right move." That completely seems ass backwards.
No.
In the real world.
Not really.
But
not
when you consider world. Anna Wintour,
yeah,
who I'm sure is a huge fan of this show.
she will be now.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's a damn good one. And you did mention my first movie boss that I came to think of is pretty much directly inspired by Anna Wintour. It's Miranda Priestly, who is the boss in The Devil Wears Prada. It played, of course, by Meryl Streep. Has Wintour seen the movie? Like, has she commented at all on The Devil Wears Prada?
I don't know if she's commented. I think she has seen the movie.
I know she's heard of the book, because they were not a fan of that.
Yeah.
And when I mean they I
oh,
mean
sorry, you asking if she's seen The Devil Wears Prada. Yeah. I don't know. I know she's seen the September issue.
Yeah. Yeah, obviously.
I don't know about the other one.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure either. But the thing I like about Miranda Priestly is she speaks very quietly. You know, she will be insulting the living shit out of you and just making you feel this big, but she will not raise her voice. She is not the kind of belligerent boss. You know, every once in a while she'll yell for an assistant or she'll yell for her coffee or her steak. But she does not, she never, if she will cut you down quieter than I'm talking right now.
I just have a vision in my head of coffee and steak. Just sitting in her office eating steak
drinking coffee. Oh, awesome. Yeah. No, it's an awesome performance. And then, yeah, certainly after seeing the September issue, yeah, it becomes that much more awesome because you can.
What I like about her, I think, is that, you know, I mean, this is going to sound terrible, but I think you might picture someone like her being really passive aggressive. And I think she's not passive aggressive. She just tells it like it is.
Yeah.
And I think in the world of fashion and publishing, there's a lot of sort of backbiting and that kind of stuff. She just tells you right to your face, you know, you're not good enough. You're not, you know, you're not, that's not good enough. I need something else.
You know what the funny thing is? That's actually, sometimes it's actually a brush of fresh air. I would rather somebody be difficult, but consistently difficult than erratic. If somebody's erratic and you can't stay two moves ahead of them, mm-hmm, then it's insane trying to deal with them. But at least, you know, Anna Wintour and Miranda Priestly, they've got no use for a lot of people and they want things the way they want things, but they're very clear about what they want.
Yeah.
So that's mine. What's your next one?
My next one is from the film The Runaways. Kim Fowley was the manager of the band, and in the film he's played by Michael Shannon, who's great actor.
He's awesome in everything.
And I don't know if you call him the boss so much, but I guess he kind of is the boss. The scene that I really like in that film is where the band is rehearsing in like a trailer. Have you seen the film?
Yeah.
And he's just pelting them. He's got a couple of his cronies there and they're just pelting them with like everything, including dog shit. And it's just funny because he's saying, "This is how audiences are going to treat you. You have to be able to put up with this." And I just thought that was just a great, I don't know. It was a great image of a boss just kind of putting you through hell.
I was actually pissed that I didn't think of this because I wasn't a huge fan of The Runaways. There was stuff I liked, but stuff I didn't like. So I was nuts about it on a whole. But I did love Michael Shannon in that movie. I loved him, you know, seeing what the pervy fans are gonna see in this band in coming up with the songs. And yeah, like you say, like the throwing of the crap. they end with that great title card saying that you can still see Kim Fowley on Hollywood Boulevard. He's the one with the green hair and the walker. It takes kind of a certain sort of vision to market a band, and he's got this twisted little vision of what he wants the Runaways to be.
Yeah.
And he is really, really awesome in that. I was pissed that you thought of that and I didn't, actually. Well, my next one is certainly much more lowbrow. My next one is J. Jonah Jameson in the Spider-Man films. This is played by J.K. Simmons.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, Coen Brothers regular. He's got that, you know, kind of gruff voice. Yeah. He speaks like McGruff the Crime Dog.
Juno's dad.
Yeah, Juno's dad. Of course he's Juno's dad. And he's got the ridiculous hair with, you know, with the gray wings and it goes dark at the top. He's got the mustache and he just speaks a mile a minute. He's bitingly sarcastic. Have you seen any of them?
I've seen the first one, and my problem is, of course, I haven't seen the other ones, and I can't really remember the first one, because it's probably, what, 10 years now?
Yeah. So, time flies. Yeah. You can give part 3 a miss. If you ever want to, I said this in the last show, you can see part 2 any Sunday, just tune to Channel 39. Every single Sunday, it's on, I swear to God. And he's actually pretty damn good in that one, because his son's getting married. So along with his normal boss shtick, he's like the one of the parents at a wedding.
So he's a newspaper editor? Is that
yeah.
Sort of, yeah. So that's a great kind of boss role to play anyway.
Yeah. And he's kind of a slimy editor as well. Like he's moving sponsors around. He's making up stories to go on the front page. They said, you know, don't you trust me? Because the only person I trust is my barber. Well, it's a great character and he does it so well. So that one, I'd be remiss if I left that one off. So now we're going to get into, I'm going to be kind of fascinated because we're going to get into the stuff that I don't really know. Okay. So what is your next one?
My next one is, okay, so this film, I don't know if anybody has seen it. It's really worth tracking down if you haven't. It's a 2007 film, maybe 2006, called The Boss of It All. It's a Lars von Trier film.
Oh boy.
And Lars is very well known for doing sort of crazy, intense, you know, movies that are very hard to watch.
Did that play last week at the Lightbox? Did I just miss that?
I don't know if that one was actually part of the retrospective. I don't think it was. Anyway, it's worth tracking down. It's The Boss of It All. It's a really funny movie. Now, the weird gimmick of the film, and I'll have to say this before I talk about the character, is that he filmed it with this weird camera technique that was sort of randomized camera angles. So he had this sort of weird robot or something hooked up to the camera so that every, you know, random number of seconds it would just change the camera angle. So it's
why am I not surprised?
I don't know, like that was the way, it was sort of a stupid thing to do because it kind of distracts you from the film and the script, which is quite funny. But the story of The Boss of It All is actually very, very funny. If you like Nordic comedies, it's very, very sort of deadpan and funny. It's about a guy who owns an IT company. And he's trying to sell it to this Icelandic investor. And the funny part is that he has invented this character called the Boss of It All. He is too, I don't know, he's too passive to make hard decisions with his employees. So he's invented this boss above him. And so he says, well, you know, it's not my decision to lay you off or not my decision to reorganize the company. It's the big boss, you know. And so for years this has been going along. And the problem is now that this Icelandic investor wants to buy the company, he wants to meet this person. So the real boss, who doesn't want to be known as the boss, hires an actor to do this. And it's hilarious. Like the actor realizes at a certain point what kind of power he has. And gets into all kinds of mischief at the office. So, you know, he shows up at the office. He, within a couple of minutes, like, he's having sex with one of the receptionists. And, like, he's just having a blast. But it leads to all kinds of weird sort of moral dilemmas. And it's a really, really funny movie. And I'm surprised more people haven't heard of it.
I am definitely going to track that down now. My experience with von Trier has only been Dogville.
Oh, okay.
So,
the one or two films I haven't actually seen.
Dogville?
Yeah.
Oh, I'd love to hear what you think of Dogville. But that sounds awesome. That sounds like a really... And funny, like, because Lord knows, Dogville is not funny.
No. No, and that's the thing. People don't realize that he can be very funny.
He's a funny guy?
Yeah.
How long is it? Because he doesn't do short movies.
No, it's not long. I think it's like 90 minutes or something. It's
well,
a
that's
comedy,
doable.
Right? Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'll dig it out. I'll find it if I have the DVD somewhere and I'll
nice. We're going to be at the bar next week, so...
Exactly.
I'm going to lean on you for this one a little bit. My next one is Jeff Sheldrake. That's played by Fred McMurray in The Apartment. Now, before I get into why I dig him, I'm gonna lean to you because the one thing I keep hearing over and over is that in The Apartment he plays against type.
Yeah.
How? because I like Fred McMurray. I only know him from The Apartment,
okay,
and from Double Indemnity.
Yeah.
So is that the thing? Like, he's usually playing kind of like a more...
The most well-known role that Fred McMurray played was probably later in his career, which was as the father on a TV sitcom called My Three Sons.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, you know, the father. He was like Father Knows Best, or he was Leave It to Beaver's dad, or, you know. So people had this image. And I think even earlier in his career, he played characters that were very straight-laced. And
so he's more squeaky clean.
Yeah.
Whereas in The Apartment, he's a big old scumbag.
Slime, yeah.
And the funny thing is that in The Apartment, the lead character played by Jack Lemmon, C.C. Baxter, he looks up to him because he's the boss. And the ingenue, Fran Kubelik, played by Shirley MacLaine. And I would say that she's the original Manic Pixie Dream Girl, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
She looks up to him because she's got a thing for men with power or something like that. And she's got a thing for married men. But he's just such a slime. Like, we are sitting back here, watching the way he operates, thinking, are both of them nuts?
I mean, it was a different era, and there was just respect for hierarchy and authority, and there was really no way to sort of get around that. I think people just realized you have to do what the boss tells you.
Yeah, and yeah, if you're an employee, you want to be the boss. If you're a female employee, maybe you want to hit that with the boss. He's kind of... Now that I think about it, he's kind of the original Don Draper.
Yeah, that's a good comparison.
You know, and not to spoil The Apartment, and if you haven't seen The Apartment, for the love of God, pause this podcast and track yourself down a copy of The Apartment, because it is friggin' awesome. But when the chips are down, when kind of everything in The Apartment comes to a head, he just bails out and says, "No, nuts to this. I got, you know, this is not my problem," when it is very, very much his problem. And I love him. He's, as I said, like you say, he's kind of the embodiment of what these people want to be or want to be with, and what they want to be with is just such a slime.
Mm.
No, love it, love it, love it. And it's fantastic. And the other thing I do love as well is that even though Jack Lemmon, C.C. Baxter, throws him the key to the apartment day after day after day, he never calls him by his name. He always just calls him Buddy Boy. Always just calals him Buddy Boy. And it's such a great character. What's your next one? I need to learn about another film.
All right, I'm getting more obscure as we go here. The next one I thought of was in a film called Police Adjective, which is a Romanian film that was at TIFF about 2 years ago.
Now you're just making up movies.
No, I'm not. No. Police Adjective, the character I'm interested in is a police captain. And the story is of a police, I guess, constable, detective, whatever, plainclothes guy, whose job it is to tail this little teenage kid who is apparently dealing drugs. And it turns out that the kid is just smoking pot with his friends. The cop, after going through excruciatingly boring stakeouts for weeks, doesn't really see the point in pursuing this case and goes into his boss and says, you know, this is a stupid law, you know, charging this kid with possession of pot or whatever. You know, in the rest of the European Union, for instance, this isn't even really an offense. You know, in Prague, for instance, they don't even bother. They just... And the cop, captain, just kind of, you know, straightens up in his chair, tells the cop to go and get the dictionary. This is an amazing set piece in the film. Tells him to go get the dictionary and says, you know, you're talking about your conscience. Read to me the definition of conscience, you know. And then he says, oh, you're talking about justice now. Read the definition of justice. Then they have this whole conversation about the definition of police. And the whole point of this film is that, yes, like it or hate it, your job is not to follow your conscience. You're a police officer in a state mechanism of you know, whatever it might be. Your job is to uphold the law. And if the law says this is illegal, your job is to go and prosecute this kid, no matter how you feel about it. And it's interesting because it's about Romania, who have come out of a long dictatorship where lots of terrible things were done because they were, you know, that was the law.
Yeah.
So there's an added layer of sort of interesting political, you know, subtext there, I guess. But it's a really, really good performance.
Sorry, it's called what again?
Police Adjective.
Police Adjective. Jeez. That does sound really, really cool. And it's Romania, and it's new, you said, right?
Yeah, it's 2009, I think.
Might be able to track that one down. We'll see how...
Could be on Netflix.
So. We'll see how the Romanian section is at my local my local place where I still go to rent movies. Well, actually, that leads very, very nicely into my next one. This is the cool thing. My next character doesn't have an actual name. He's just known as the police captain. And it's in So I Married an Axe Murderer. Now, I don't know how long has it been since you watched it?
A while.
A while? Okay. So, the captain is played by Alan Arkin.
Mm.
Okay? And he's got all these scenes with Tony LaPaglia. And LaPaglia wants him to be the kind of hard ass that you see on, like, Dragnet.
Okay.
You know, or that you see on like, Magnum PI or that kind of thing. Who will ream him out and will... He's tired of defending his screwball antics to the commissioner.
Mm.
And Alan Arkin, as the captain, he's very pleasant. He goes, you know, I think he's like, you look stressed. Is everything okay?
He's a new age captain.
He is. Yeah. And he explains, he goes, well, we don't have a commissioner. We have a committee. Sometimes there's meetings. I can defend your antics to the committee. And he's just, he's so sweet. He seems very, very straight-laced, but he seems like the nice guy. There is a great scene where he tries to be a hard ass, and he lets loose with, like, these ethnic slurs and everything like that. And I believe he uses the term spaghetti bender. Because he's, you know, because LaPaglia is Italian, and it's the best thing he can come up with.
Wow.
He's so great. It, just watching somebody who's nice and who somebody else wants to be something different. It's so funny. He doesn't really do all that much, but he's just, it's a great role, and it's played by the perfect guy.
And that's a film that needs more love. That's a great, Mike Myers, one of his best
films. The funny thing is, for a while there, everybody was quoting it, like in the 90s, like, yeah, everybody seemed to love this film, and it just, like, vanished. Right. I don't even think this is on Blu-ray.
I don't even know what has the director ever done. I mean, this is a film where it sort of just exists in a weird sort of vacuum.
Yeah, nothing, actually.
Wow.
That was his... He did an episode of Spin City, and he's, yeah, apparently he's working... Oh, he's working on Parenthood and Pan Am right now. Like, he's directing episodes
guy.
Of that. He's,
yeah,
a TV guy. But, and, like, not only that, but just to kind of get off on a little tangent here, it's, I think, the only or one of the few films where Mike Myers plays somebody normal.
Yeah.
And my God, is he funny?
Oh, he's got all of his good... I mean, he's got all his whole Scottish stuff in that,
yeah,
film. It's just amazing.
Yeah, I really wish that, like,
yeah,
everybody involved. I wish the director did more of these.
Yeah.
I wish Mike Myers did more of these.
Although I think Mike Myers has kind of used up his bag of tricks, but I think this, as his first film, he had a lot of stuff that he just wanted to get out on
well,
screen.
Well, he kept playing characters, right? Like, he kept,
yeah,
doing Wayne or doing Shrek,
yeah,
or he tried to do another one with a Love Guru, and I just think, buddy, just... play a guy. Just play a normal guy who's got a job, or in this case, he's a poet.
That's a job.
Sure, yeah.
Sure.
You know, and we'll watch you. And especially if you cast people like Alan Arkin as the police captain who just doesn't know what he's supposed to do. Well, we've each got one left. So what is your last one that I believe would probably be the most obscure?
This will be the most obscure. I don't even
more
know.
More than the Romanian?
Oh, way more. I don't,
okay,
even know if you can get this film on a region one.
Okay.
I don't even know. It's a Uruguayan film.
See, now, how am I supposed to prove these?
No, I'm telling you, this,
okay,
is actually, it could be maybe the most famous Uruguayan
we'll
film.
Put this to the Google test in a minute.
Yeah, and it's called Whiskey. And funny that we're drinking whiskey. So
yes.
This is actually...
Well done.
But whiskey is a phrase that people in, I believe in Latin America, and certainly in Uruguay, they say this instead of saying cheese when people pose for pictures.
Okay.
So, whiskey is, I think it was 2004 or so. It's really funny. It's in a way, it's another one of those deadpan comedies. It could have come from somewhere like Denmark or Norway. It's Uruguayans are kind of the weird sort of Nordic, strange Nordic Latin Americans. It's hard to believe it. But I have a bit of a love for Uruguay because my wife and I went there in 2004. But anyway, the story is about a guy called Jacobo who owns a sock factory. It's not a big factory. It's a little factory. He's got, you know, a couple of employees. And what happens is that his long-lost brother, who's moved to Buenos Aires in Argentina, is coming back to visit him. I believe it's something to do with, like, maybe their mother has died or something, and they have to bury her, or it's like a year later and they have to do some kind of a ceremony. But his brother's coming to visit, and his brother is really successful. He lives in Buenos Aires, which is, you know, the city of Buenos Aires is probably 7 or 8 times the size of Uruguay, like,
yeah,
the,
yeah,
population. So he's coming to visit, and Jacobo feels like a failure. So he convinces one of his employees, Marta, to pretend to be his wife for this weekend trip. And it's just the most excruciatingly funny, uncomfortable kind of humor that you've ever seen. Like, what kind of a boss would ask his employee, just pretend to be my wife for a weekend. My brother's coming to visit.
Fred McMurray?
Come to my house, live in my house, wear this fake wedding ring, sleep in my room. You know, they're not going to sleep together, but, you know, just pretend that we're married. Pretend, you know, tell some stories about our incredible marriage and our honeymoon and our life together. It's just the most hilarious movie. If you like that kind of uncomfortable humor, and everybody in it is awesomely deadpan. It's very
Where in the world did you catch up with this movie?
It's kind of hard to remember. I guess
if it wasn't for the fact that I was looking at it on Wikipedia right now, I'd be convinced that you're making this up.
No, you know what? I think I knew about it because the filmmaker... one of the filmmakers had a film at TIFF a few years ago, and I mean, of course, we visited Uruguay, so we sort of knew a little bit about the country, and you sort of know about the films and literature and that sort of thing. And this film was always sort of pointed out as a really good film. I think I might have bought it when I was there, but when I watched it, I just thought it was the most hilarious thing, and like such a weird relationship. I won't spoil it, but it's the sort of movie that. I don't know. You'll never see this kind of stuff on film. It's, you know, it's not a Hollywood story.
No,
it's just that's why I love sort of these small obscure films.
Yeah, no, and like we're looking like even the poster. It's this weird kind of pencil art absurdist like take on American Gothic almost.
And whiskey is that, you know, like I said, it's the phrase people say when they want you to smile for a picture, and it's that sort of false.
Oh, okay.
Posed
okay.
Kind of happiness that is basically
okay.
What he's trying to
okay.
capture.
Well, I might have to borrow that off you if you know trust me.
No.
With such things, my last boss, I think, is going to be the one out of this whole list that is probably most familiar to people. It's Bill Lumberg in Office Space, and anybody who has ever worked in an office has probably had a boss. Like Bill Lumberg, who is, like you kind of mentioned earlier, very passive aggressive, has a way of saying things where he's trying to direct you, but make it sound like he's casual and just not dealing with problems and just trying to coast down the middle of professional life with the least amount of resistance.
I was just laughing about this with my dad the other day. We were talking about the American propensity to use the phrase, go ahead and it's like, why do you say that? There's no reason to say go ahead and. So the scene where he says, I'm going to need you to go ahead and come in on Saturday, and I think I'm going to need you to go ahead and come in on Sunday too.
Well, it gets me, that's the one thing that gets me about the way he talks. The other one that gets me about the way he talks is when he starts every single sentence with, yeah. Yeah, it's like, well, what do you mean? Yeah, you know, you're not responding to what I'm saying. You certainly don't agree with what I'm saying. You're just, it's your little non sequitur.
You're waiting for your turn to talk.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And I do love the moment where the two proficiency experts, one of them played by John C. McGinley, they're talking to him about Milton, the squirrely guy played by Stephen Root. You know, have you seen my stapler? They're talking about him and how he was actually fired years ago, but nobody actually told him. And he kept getting paid. And they said, we fixed the glitch so he's not going to get paid anymore, but somebody still needs to go over there and tell him he's fired. And he's like, oh, I don't want to do that. Like, dude, you're the boss. There are so many, I think it's kind of the sad thing is that there are so many bosses out there, not mine, there are so many bosses out there who don't want to actually lead. They just want to show up, get their paycheck, tell people what to do.
They don't want to be the boss.
They don't want to be the boss. They don't want to actually be the one to actually say, this is what you're doing. They just want to take the path of least resistance, least resistance from those below them and those above them, and just keep getting things done. And Bill Lumberg is the alpha and omega.
It's like a friendly boss. It reminds me of the parents who want to be their kids' best friends.
Yeah, because that's the thing. Like he always strolls by the cubicle and, how's it going, Milton?
Yeah,
yeah. He doesn't just.
He wants to be one of the gang.
Yeah, doesn't start things with, you know, can I get a minute? Can we talk for a second? Yeah. Just, hey, how's things?
Mm-hmm.
Bill Lumberg and the kind of character that he represents. It's everything that's wrong with office culture, and I think there's a very strong reason why he exists in Office Space and. when I think bosses, that's where you go. My only little caveat to this list, just to kind of end things off, is I haven't actually seen 9 to 5. I saw the musical a month and a half ago. But that would be, like, that. I know that story, even though I haven't seen the film. And it's that kind of boss. He's sort of the bridge between the present and the Don Draper, Fred McMurray boss, where he's still acting inappropriately, but it's around the time of Women's Lib, so they're really not happy with it anymore.
It's funny to note that a lot of the films that I think of as office kind of boss movies are very women, female focused. So Working Girl, 9 to 5, there's one called Career Woman or something. You know, there's a lot of...
Devil Wears Prada?
Yeah, there's a lot of films about women sort of thinking about their career, and there's not a lot of films about men struggling with their career. I mean, I don't know. I can't think of any.
Office Space?
I suppose that's the only one. And it's a comedy. Like, it's not... I don't know. It's interesting to think that it's...
Swimming with Sharks is another one.
Well, I guess so. And maybe Glengarry Glen Ross.
Yeah, that's all dudes.
It's all dudes. Yeah, that's interesting. Death of a Salesman. I don't know. We haven't seen any of those, or I haven't seen any of those.
I've seen Glengarry Glen Ross, but not nearly recent enough to talk about
it. I haven't seen it as a film.
Oh, okay. But, it's a play.
It was a play, apparently.
Yeah. Next week, James will be starting the drama podcast.
Yeah. Have you seen Horrible Bosses? Like, this is a recent film.
Yeah, I have, actually. And the funny thing about Horrible Bosses is that the bosses in that are just completely a cartoon.
So there's not even any hint of reality.
No. All of them, they've got they take little elements of the types of bosses that are out there. They take a man-eater, they take a complete cock-up, and they take the ass. They again, the swimming with sharks.
Cock up on an ass.
Yeah.
Be careful with how you...
My show. The whiskey is officially kicking in. But they're all cartoons. They're all very much caricature type. There's a reason why they want to kill them all, right? And as funny as I thought Jennifer Aniston was in this movie, I don't know that kind of boss exists.
Interesting that she was in Office Space, too.
Yeah, and you know the funny thing was, I really liked her as this character. She was really, really funny when she's not... This is, I think, one of the very few times I've seen her not play Jennifer Aniston. There's some times where she's played a little bit more down note, stuff like The Good Girl.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. But this is the first time that she was still playing very brash and very outlandish, like very, very... You know, above the titles, but she wasn't playing Rachel from Friends.
Right.
So I kind of hope she does more of this kind of role. But Horrible Bosses was, yeah, you know, we've seen bosses like this, but not this kind of cartoon. And that's it for this matinee cast. Come on back for episode 47 on December 5th. We'll be talking about Lars von Trier's Melancholia. I'm sorry, the next episode's going to be a much better film.
That's the one I wanted to
I'm so sorry.
You made me see Jay.
I know. You know what? I actually do feel bad, because over the last little while, like, I've been making some people see some pretty bad movies.
Yeah, it's okay.
As I said, the episode before you was The Mum Diary, and neither Rachel or I were nuts about that. You go back a little while, there was... The worst one was one of the worst films, if not the worst film I've seen all year, is Cowboys and Aliens.
Oh, yeah.
And we saw that for our podcast. So
I wouldn't have
to seen. Everybody who has listened to the show or been on this show, if you've seen something you did not like because of me, including James, I am sorry.
But it's kind of fun to talk about those movies.
It is. I have more fun talking about the ones I don't like than the ones I want to praise.
It's easier than writing about them.
That's true. James's site is torontoscreenshots.com, where you can find all sorts of stuff, including... about a week ago, a very introspective post, which I recommend you read, called "The Man." Was it "The Man Behind the Curtain"?
That was today, actually.
That's okay.
Yeah.
So do check that out, and if people want to follow you on Twitter,
it's TO Screenshots, just for the shorter handle.
Very nice. My own blog is thematinee.ca. For more podcasting content, you can find back episodes at thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them on Blueberry and the iTunes Music Store. They both give you handy ways to subscribe for free and get alerts when new episodes drop. The whiskey is totally fucking kicking in.
I want to thank our sponsors, Dude DeCiel Brewery and Jameson's Irish Whiskey.
Well done. Feedback on J. Edgar, on your own boss movies, and especially on ideas for the matinee cast, can be sent to ryan@thematinee.ca. Twitter.com/matinee_CA, Facebook.com/darkmatinee, or the comment section of the blog. Any last thoughts? How's the blondies?
Oh, excellent.
Well done. Well, for James, I'm Ryan McNeil. We'll see you at the matinee.
You'll find me in the matinee, the dark of the matinee.